The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated May 26, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block capital lettering in an off-purple tint. It is superimposed upon a darker purple, but it's not really purple. It's more like a mulberry color, upon which is posted a portrait of Leo XIV, an American pope. He is smiling at the camera. He wears glasses. He has short, cropped gray hair, silvery gray, with a receding hairline. He's wearing the papal skull cap in white. His hands are folded across his chest. He wears the white lace-trimmed cassock, that would be, over which there is a very vivid red satiny textured looking cape, over which there is a richly gold embroidered stole, again in a purple color, but not exactly purple, more of a maroon or wine or mulberry. He's wearing the papal ring in gold. Beginning with today's reading is The View. Technology, Our Data, Ourselves, by Spencer Cox and Frank H. McCourt, Jr. Access to online services is as fundamental to modern life as electricity or water. And just as we expect our electricity to be reliable and our water to be clean, we should have high expectations for the Internet. Our data represent our personhood. They encompass our relationships, our thoughts, our interests, our created memories. That information should be controlled by us, not by big tech. Utah's groundbreaking new Digital Choice Act will help make that goal possible by finally giving people agency over their data on social media. When the law takes effect July 1, 2026, it will mark a bold step toward giving people, not platforms, control of their personal information. Under the Act, individuals will be able to use open-source protocols to seamlessly move their content and relationships to new apps if they are unhappy with the experience on a social media site. This portability and interoperability will give people the freedom to manage their digital lives without losing years of personal history. The law also gives people the power to delete all their data when they decide to leave a platform. For years, it's been common wisdom that social media is not the product we are. Users do not pay for access to social media platforms because social media platforms profit by selling our attention to advertisers. The Digital Choice Act flips that relationship to put users in control. Today's social media giants use addictive algorithms to hook users, harvest data, and manipulate behavior for profit. Laws like the Digital Choice Act put people first, creating choices by lowering barriers to competition and opening the door for new social media platforms. History shows that interoperability works. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 spurred innovation in mobile services and broadband. The UK's open banking reforms of 2018 unlocked a wave of fintech startups. As it stands today, people's livelihoods and digital personhood are continually at risk because companies control their data. We see this lesson playing out far too often. January 19, when TikTok temporarily shut down, millions of Americans lost access to the relationships and content they had created over many years. The Digital Choice Act would have allowed users to take their data, content, and communities from TikTok and move them to the platform of their choice. Many others fall victim to arbitrary decisions by platforms that have no meaningful oversight and provide little recourse. Laws like Utah's enable creators and everyday people to migrate their content and communities to other platforms. They can also share posts across platforms in real time in order to reach their friends and communities wherever they are. The underlying problem of platforms effectively holding our data captive and using it against us is emerging as a defining challenge of our time. It is at the root of a business model that's harming our children, polarizing our neighborhoods, and undermining our national security. The Digital Choice Act starts by addressing these issues with social media, where the harms are arguably most acute. However, the recent bankruptcy of 23andMe, which put the DNA of the company's 15 million customers at risk, is a reminder these questions have far broader implications. The consequences will only become more extreme as artificial intelligence drives larger portions of the economy and the Internet. It is urgent that we fix this before it is too late. Utah has long been a leader in digital privacy. In 2024, it passed two laws, SB 194 and HB 464, to safeguard minors, enhance parental controls, hold social media companies accountable for mental health harms. As policymakers and parents, we have a duty to go further. We urge other states, other countries, and the federal government to follow Utah's lead. Data rights are human rights. They should be protected by law. If people have the power to move their information across platforms, it will permanently change a broken system that's hurting our kids, communities, and country. Data interoperability is possible. Social media platforms already have access to open source protocols that make our information portable. Millions of people are set to benefit as better laws and better tech facilitate data portability and app interoperability. We can no longer accept a status quo where corporations hold the keys to our online lives. It is time to build a future where individuals own and control their digital identities. Shouldn't you own you? Spencer Cox and Frank McCourt Jr. wrote this. Cox is governor of Utah and outgoing chair of the National Governors Association. McCourt Jr. is executive chairman of McCourt Global, founder of Project Liberty, and author of Our Biggest Fight. Turning the page now to the View opener, The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Trump moves to bring the Saudis even closer. May 13, U.S. President Donald Trump will open the first multi-country foreign trip of his second term with a stop in Saudi Arabia. So this has already occurred, underscoring ties with Riyadh remain a Trump priority. He will also visit Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. While a hoped-for diplomatic breakthrough normalizing Saudi-Israeli relations will have to wait, at least until the Gaza war ends, plenty of other opportunities will allow Trump and Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, to leave their meeting claiming diplomatic victory. The Saudi need a U.S. security guarantee is less urgent than during Trump's first term. Iran, still the Saudis' main regional rival, is now far weaker after Israel's battering of its allies Hamas and Hezbollah and the ouster of Tehran-aligned Syrian strongman Bashar Assad. It's also unlikely Trump could deliver the two-thirds Senate supermajority needed for a formal defense treaty. But even without the Israeli piece of the diplomatic puzzle, Trump intends to offer a new level of defense cooperation, including a public pledge to defend the kingdom if attacked by Iran or its remaining allies. That list may no longer include the Houthis, for now at least. May 6, Trump announced a surprise ceasefire with the Yemeni rebels, ending U.S. airstrikes in exchange for a halt to Houthi attacks on Red Sea shipping. The deal, brokered by Oman, lets Trump claim a win and reduces immediate threats to Saudi oil infrastructure. The kingdom's also seeking access to cutting-edge U.S. technologies, like advanced semiconductors for its expanding tech and AI sectors, an area in which it lags behind the neighboring UAE. To secure that access, Washington will insist Riyadh curtail high-level tech cooperation with China. The two leaders will likely announce a landmark civil nuclear cooperation agreement. The Saudis want the ability to enrich their own uranium, allowing for both civilian energy development and potential military use. U.S. negotiators have pushed for restrictions on their ability to develop their own fuel cycle, along with rigorous inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency. A compromise may emerge, allowing limited enrichment under U.S. supervision. They will also sign trade and investment deals worth hundreds of billions of dollars. Just days after Trump's inauguration, the Crown Prince pledged to invest $600 billion in the U.S. He may offer more specifics. Trump and MBS will also discuss Iran and Yemen, both still serious security headaches for Riyadh. The Crown Prince needs to shield his ambitious Vision 2030 reform and development plan from threats by the Houthis and Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Without a formal defense pact with Washington, maintaining the current thaw with Tehran is especially important, particularly if pressure from Israel or the Trump administration provokes Iran to retaliate against America's regional partners. To avoid becoming a target, the Saudi government sent Defense Minister Prince Khalid bin Salman to Iran in April, the highest-level visit between the two nations in decades. Riyadh has also offered to mediate U.S.-Iran negotiations over the future of Tehran's nuclear program and possible sanctions relief. And while the U.S. Houthi ceasefire reduces tensions, it remains fragile. Any renewed escalation, for example, caused by ongoing Houthi attacks on Israel, could still provoke retaliation against Saudi oil infrastructure or U.S. bases in the kingdom. For all these reasons, the U.S. President and Saudi Crown Prince will be all smiles and lavish promises during Trump's Middle East trip, but the realities of the region in Gaza, Iran, and the waters off Yemen carry risks both are determined to avoid. This is not a MAGA Pope. Back to the cover story in Pope Leo 14. This is a short item. By Philip Elliott, the new Pope is an American. Do not for a minute think he wants to make America great again. When Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost became leader to the world's 1.4 billion Catholics and took the name Leo XIV, the former missionary stepped into a slot that left him as an ideological check on a certain breed of American styled Catholicism, which in recent years has been ascendant in Washington as it has drifted into more conservative lanes than its global brethren. With Vice President J.D. Vance and six of the nine Supreme Court justices as part of his flock, Leo XIV becomes the most powerful Catholic both in the world and among Americans. And Leo XIV, known in Rome as the Latin Yankee, clearly represents a rejection by the Vatican of the intense lobbying from rich Americans to install a pontiff sympathetic to President Donald Trump, who went so far as to joke he should be a simultaneous pope and president. Another collision between the civic leader of the U.S. and the sacred leader of the Catholic Church seems inevitable, especially given Trump's obsession with a nationalistic agenda that would co-opt Christianity in service of his political goals. Within hours of his election, the MAGAverse seemed to be gunning for the new pontiff in nakedly political terms. While still a cardinal, the new pope had been a critic of Trump's, especially on his approach to immigration. His last post on X, before heading into the no-phones-allowed conclave, lashed Trump for a joint appearance with Salvadoran President Nayib Bukele, in which the pair made an extrajudicial deportation of an immigrant into a joke. The Vatican power players apparently knew what they were doing, and they did it with an enthusiasm that suggests the Catholic Church understands the assignment. And the brief opener here, one page. The True Meaning of an American Pope by Christopher Hale. There's a photo here. It's small. Newly elected Pope Leo XIV prays on a balcony at St. Peter's Basilica, May 8. Mostly I see whitewashed or stone walls, whitish, grayish, brownish, tan, but kind of tucked in between these walls, really tucked in between, is the Pope. The balcony in this photo does not actually protrude from the walls. It's almost flush with them, and the Pope is tucked behind the balcony, and he's praying. He has his hands to his lips, and he's tilted his head. His white cap is very visible, as are the white cassock and just a portion of the red cape. In front of him then stands a towering gold crucifix. May 8, this is by Christopher Hale. May 8, I stood on the colonnades of St. Peter's Square on the beautiful afternoon a new pope was elected. Shoulder to shoulder with pilgrims from every corner of the globe, the roar that erupted when white smoke billowed from the Sistine Chapel chimney is something I will never forget. The earth beneath my feet shook as the bells of the ancient basilica tolled. And then the announcement, the unknown Robert Francis Prevost had been elected Vicar of Jesus Christ. The cardinal electors had chosen a Midwesterner to be the successor of Saint Peter. As the red velvet drapes parted on the balcony, we knew we were seeing the dawn of a new era for the Church, and in some ways for America, too. For the first time ever, the most famous American in the world is not the president, or a Hollywood icon, or tech billionaire. It's the Pope. This is more than a Catholic triumph. It is a cultural watershed for the U.S. In a society that often equates American influence with might or money or celebrity, now our foremost representative on the global stage is a humble man in white robes, preaching love, justice, and mercy. For all the lofty historical comparisons, sometimes the ordinariness of this moment is what strikes me most. After the white smoke cleared and the crowds drifted home singing hymns, I did something utterly mundane. I pulled out my phone and shot off a text to an old contact I had in my phone from a decade past, except that old contact is now the Pope. I thumbed, hitting send, with a mix of giddy disbelief and pride. Almost immediately, the message bubble turned green. Undeliverable. Of course it did. Father Bob had traded his iPhone for the fisherman's ring, and his private cell number was probably deactivated by the Vatican within minutes of Habemus Papam. I laughed at myself for thinking I could just text the Pope, but impulse itself says so much. We Americans are used to our leaders being just a tap away. And for a moment I forgot that my countryman on the balcony was now a universal pastor with an entirely different life. Still, the very fact that the new Pope had a number in my contacts list is a testament to his accessibility and American-ness. For an American Catholic like me, that hint of shared culture is both charming and reassuring. It reminds us the papacy is not an abstract institution. It is held by a person, and now that person happens to hail from our own shores. Pope Leo XIV's election has instantly made the rituals of the Vatican feel a touch more familiar to Americans, and perhaps made the idea of holiness feel a touch more attainable. Beyond the novelty and pride, many of us are looking to this new pope with a deeper longing. Could this be a moment of moral and institutional renewal for America? It's no secret our country's been sorely divided in recent years. We've endured bruising political fights, a crisis of truth and civility, even an insurrection, and the ongoing temptation of authoritarian politics. Trust in institutions is at a historic low. Faith communities themselves are riven by conflict. Americans, in short, are hungry for healing, a restoration of integrity in our public life, and compassion in our communities. In this context, the first American pope feels providential. Who better than an American steeped in the ideals of liberty under God to remind the world faith and freedom stand together against loneliness and isolationism? Do not be surprised if he soon uses his moral pulpit to gently but firmly push back against the siren song of authoritarian leaders, be they on the international stage or lurking in our domestic politics. His voice, coming from an American who cannot be dismissed as anti-American, might uniquely rally the conscience of our people. At the very least, his example of servant leadership, prioritizing the poor, dialoguing with opponents, renouncing worldly power, is a much-needed antidote to the cynical power grabs we've grown accustomed to. This is a time when America's image is often tied to loud, combative nationalism and the cult of personality. How poetic, then, that as we turn the page, the world's spotlight shifts to an American known for quiet service and spiritual depth. Pope Leo XIV's rise does not erase our nation's struggles, but it does offer a new narrative for what American leadership can mean. It suggests America's greatest export might not be our entertainment or weaponry, but our capacity for moral vision. Time Off. For Love or Money by Eliana Doctorman. A decade ago, before Celine Song scored 2 Oscar nominations for her debut film, Past Lives, she was a struggling playwright searching for odd jobs to make ends meet. She did not have the latte art skills to be a barista and could not land a steady babysitting gig without prior experience. But with a tip from a friend already in the industry, she secured a role as a matchmaker in Manhattan. A naive creature might assume Song's meetings with clients seeking their soulmates involved conversations about hobbies, work-life balance, or procreation. In fact, the initial consultation was far more mathematical. They listed their requirements for height, income, age, and yes, race. All of the men would say fit. What they meant was 20 BMI, just one level above underweight. Song remembers. The women wanted someone who was 6 feet tall. My joke was, that person is going to be 5'7" by the time you're 90. And what is the goal of marriage, if not to grow old together? All these numbers have nothing to do with that. Song lasted just 6 months on the job, but she knew as soon as she left, she would write about the experience. I learned more about people in those 6 months than I did in any other part of my life, she says. I knew more than their therapists because they were willing to tell me their heart's desires in a way that was so frank and objective. Song's sophomore writing and directorial effort for the big screen, Materialists, June 13, centers on cynical matchmaker Lucy, played by Dakota Johnson. She views her job as akin to that of a banker, taking stock of her clients' value on the dating market. The gap between what they say they want, a lifelong companion, and their shallow checklists plays as comic relief between scenes of Lucy's own search for love. Fans of Past Lives, which announced Song as a major new talent, will find parallels. Both center on a woman torn between her past and future. In her autobiographical debut, Greta Lee's stand-in for Song is prompted to reminisce about her youth in Korea when a childhood crush visits. She struggles to reconcile that self with her new identity as a New York artist married to a white man. In Materialists, Lucy is torn between a broke but doting ex, Chris Evans, and a suave rich man, Pedro Pascal, known in her business as a unicorn. But whereas Past Lives served up dreamily romantic visions of couples connecting on a spiritual level, Materialists, as its title promises, is steeped in questions of economic pragmatism. Fights over finances break up Lucy's relationship with Evan's struggling actor, who understands her on a deep level. Lucy, like Scarlett O'Hara before her, vows she'll never be poor again. Her quickest path to financial solvency is marrying rich. Lucy assesses her clients and herself using cold, unforgiving math that leaves little room for the magic of attraction. In every aspect of our lives, we talk about numbers. We talk about cars in this way, houses, jobs, Song says, during an April interview at the offices of A24, which is releasing Materialists. The movie renders conversations about money and love as text, not subtext. While marriage was once more openly an economic proposition, I don't think it's really gone away, Song says. She wants to show how we've evolved or failed to evolve in this respect, and how our commodification of people continues to affect something more spiritual and holy, love. I wanted to be honest about that. Classic British romances, in which the marriage contract is paramount to the plot, served as reference points for materialists. Pride and Prejudice, Darcy, Song points out, is a dreamboat because he's not only the love of Elizabeth Bennet's wife, but also solves her family's financial woes. Howards End is a novel more concerned with who inherits a particular house than with intimacy. The women in these stories are always being asked to make decisions between complete practicality and the entirely romantic, says Song. That dichotomy is where this movie lives. As women entered the workforce in increasing numbers in the 70s and 80s, money took a back seat to chemistry as a driving force for romance in pop culture. We never worry about Harry or Sally being able to afford New York City, and Bridget Jones' suitors are both conveniently wealthy. But Song observes that financial anxieties were still key. One of her favorite movies, Nora Ephron's You've Got Mail, derives tension from Tom Hanks' character, the owner of a Barnes & Noble-esque megastore, putting Meg Ryan's whimsical children's bookstore out of business. That's a movie openly about gentrification, Song says. Working girl dealt with class anxiety. So did Crazy Rich Asians. But the love interests in these movies are usually rich by happenstance. In fact, the heroine often objects to the man's wealth and comes around only after he proves his worth in the Darcy mold. Plenty of other films, The Notebook, Titanic, The Princess Bride, hinge on the heroines choosing the poor man she loves over a rich one who's boring at best, loathsome at worst. In materialists, money is the objective for many women, and for men it's an essential tool to attract mates. Early in the film, Lucy and a colleague discuss a surgery in which doctors break a man's legs in multiple places so he can gain up to 6 inches in height. This very real procedure is painful, requires extensive rehab, and can cost over $100,000. Lucy's world-weary assessment? It is well worth the price to expand a shorter bachelor's romantic prospects. I admit to Song, I struggled with the character of Lucy, a modern woman asserting bluntly that she would marry only a rich man, especially when she seems capable of pursuing wealth in her own career. Admittedly, as a college dropout, Lucy could probably never afford the $12 million Tribeca apartment that Pascal's character owns. And I suppose who am I to judge her in this economy? Song gestures at my wedding ring and asks me how old I was when I met my husband. 23. She nods knowingly. Song, now 36, meant her husband, Challengers and queer screenwriter Justin Kuritsky's, when she was 24. They both won a fellowship from the Edward F. Albee Foundation and shared the barn in Montauk, where that organization hosts its writers, a meet-cute that would find its way into past lives. At the time, the practicality of it all was not on my mind. We were struggling writers, happy to eat from the halal cart. Being a woman that age, you still think you can meet the love of your life on the street. By your 30s, it's clear how much money everyone's making. You need certain things. There's a hardening that happens, she says, offering her grand theory of dating. If you ask your friends who are single now what they are looking for, they might start with height. Song has spent a lot of time talking with people about their love lives. Those who hear she was a matchmaker want to ask her advice on finding a partner, while those who have seen her movies want to share their own love stories. It's a privilege. The smartest people in the world start talking about romantic love, and it reduces them to sounding like idiots, she says. You ask someone why they love their partner, they tell you it's because of some small thing they do, not because that person checked a box. Song will keep writing about love because it's at once universal and mysterious. But she does worry for the genre. Studios often send romances straight to streaming, despite the occasional breakout, like last year's Anyone But You, performing well at the box office. In one scene in Materialists, a male character dismisses dating as not that serious. Lucy shoots back, just girl, SH space T, right? That is me being open about how this is serious, SH space T. People call romances chick flicks, says Song. Of course, it's tied to misogyny. But when people say it is not important, I ask, not as important as what? When you watch a movie, we don't all know what it's like to save the world, but we know what it's like to fall in love. It's the biggest drama in our lives. It's vital, and we need to talk about it more. Materialist is also a love triangle film featuring a two-men-one-woman entanglement, much like past lives. Song rolls her eyes when I bring up the similarity. I spent the entire Past Lives release talking about how it's not a love triangle of that kind. It's actually more of a love triangle between a person's past, present, and future, she says, laughing at her own exasperation. And everyone's talking about it like love triangles are not a fundamental part of every F space CKING romance film. That's the will they, won't they. That's the tension. It is also the dream. Lucy's dilemma, being wooed by two devastatingly handsome men, beats the hellish dating scene in which her clients are rejected for facile reasons. The movie at times borders on cynicism, and working as matchmaker could make anyone jaded, but Song insists that she is, at heart, a romantic. Is it worth it? Why can't I just pursue somebody who's 6 feet tall and makes a certain amount of money? Why should I look for this thing that feels elusive and has only ever caused me heartbreak, she asks. I know from my own experience that, yes, it's definitely worth it. I wish it wasn't, because then we could just quit. But we can't quit. Time Off Movies essay, How Do We Define a Real Movie Now? By Stephanie Zakarik. Whenever a friend or colleague sees a movie before I do, the first question I ask is no longer, is it any good, but does it feel like a real movie? Everyone knows exactly what the question means, even if none of us can quite articulate it. The rise of streaming has eroded not just the movie-going experience, but also the hard-to-define qualities that have traditionally made a movie a movie. I have stopped counting the number of times a friend or acquaintance has said to me, "There's so much to stream these days, I'd rather just stay at home." But even if the theatrical experience sometimes appears to be dying, the movies are not. Young people and veteran filmmakers alike still want to make them. What is it that still draws them and us to the form? What makes some films feel real and others like sham products, worthy only of that derisive term, content? This is all new territory. But it may help to look at some recent theatrical releases, as well as a few streaming-only products, to help discern what makes a film feel like a movie today. Does a movie have to feel totally fresh? James Hawes, The Amateur, with Rami Malek, as a low-key CIA employee, intent on avenging his wife's death, is based on a 1981 Robert Little thriller that's been adapted before, but it has a satisfying aura that seems to belong on the big screen. The action takes place in splashy locales like London and Paris, and the direction has a confident muscularity. We used to get sophisticated action thrillers like this 8 or 9 times a year in the 1990s. Now, a movie like The Amateur, watched on the big screen, can awaken a sense of something we've lost. It feels like a forgotten luxury. But a work does not necessarily have to play on the big screen to feel like a movie. Conviction on the part of the filmmaker, or the actors, or both, may be the deciding factor. It is a you-know-it-when-you-see-it sort of thing. Netflix has bankrolled some terrific films over the years, from Roma to Maestro, but the next Netflix original, The Electric State, a retro-futuristic fantasy directed by the Russo brothers, released in mid-March via streaming only, achieves the dubious distinction of feeling slapdash and extravagant at once. Netflix spent some $300 million on it, yet even with its design to look cool, robot-centric special effects, it barely feels worthy of even the smallest screen. But that does not mean a direct-to-streaming entity can never feel like cinema. FX's series Shogun is an example of TV that offers the kind of visual splendor we usually have to go to the movies for. Even for die-hard movie people, cinematic TV can step in when the movies fall down on the job. What about movies that become surprise hits? Do they work because they're fun and well-made, or is the mechanism more mysterious than that? Lawrence Lamont's body buddy comedy, One of Them Days, in which Kiki Palmer and Ja play best friends who spend a crazy day trying to scrape together $1,500 in rent money, opened in January and stayed in theaters for more than 2 months. Before shifting to Netflix in early April, audiences loved it. But the film also plays beautifully on the small screen. It is hilarious, even when you're watching alone. Let's reverse engineer that equation and consider Patricia Riggins' action-adventure G20 from Amazon MGM Studios. Viola Davis plays the President of the United States, a war veteran who's forced to dust off her combat skills when crypto-terrorists invade the G20 summit in South Africa. Though the movie got only a streaming release beginning April 10, Amazon did play it for small select audiences a few days earlier, which is how I saw it. I cannot imagine enjoying this enthusiastically made but somewhat clumsy picture in my living room. But to watch Davis, a terrific actor who rarely gets the chance to let loose, crack a baddie over the head with a frying pan, the audience went nuts, and I did too. Sometimes the presence of other humans can turn a work into something greater than the sum of its parts. Movies do not have to be extravagant or expensive. Earlier this year, Steven Soderbergh released Presence, a subtle but intensely effective supernatural thriller that cost about $2 million to make. Soderbergh's elegant, sophisticated spy caper, Black Bag, released a few months later, cost quite a bit more, roughly $50 million, and did not make its money back at the box office. But that's no reflection on its quality. Now more than ever, the movie gods can be cruel. And yet, even though the movie year is still young, we've already seen one example of a perfectly movie-like movie. Ryan Coogler's Sinners fulfills every promise of what a great mainstream movie can be, and several weeks after its release, it has the box office returns to prove it. Sinners is gorgeous to look at. And though it comes laced with serious ideas about race and community, it is not hamstrung by them. It features both a big movie star, Michael B. Jordan, and an astonishing newcomer, Miles Catton, Caton, as a blues prodigy who's invited to dance with the devil. And it is about vampires, bloody, ruthless, charismatic vampires. There is music, there is steamy sex, there is gore, served up in a way that's both artful and exhilarating. Sinners is the kind of movie that sends you home thinking, okay, I just saw something. You saw what a filmmaker can do with a possibility, a camera, a cast, and crew. But maybe even more important, you became part of the almost mystical bond that a filmmaker can forge with an audience. In the movie-going equation, you are ingredient X. No movie is real without you. Kelly Conniff writes four questions and answers with Nikki Glaser, N-I-K-K-I. G-L-A-S-E-R, the comedian on the delicate art of making fun of celebrities, being mean during roasts, and the upside of her imposter syndrome. This says four questions, but I'm counting 6 paragraphs. We'll see where this leads. Question, if you had to roast anyone right now, who would it be? Answer, I would want to do it to someone who I'm furious with, and there's a lot of fodder, and who I know it would hurt deeply because of their narcissism. So there's two people who come to mind. I don't even know if I'd want to roast them because I don't think it would even land. It wouldn't hurt. Question, you hosted the Golden Globes this year. What was the energy like in the room? Answer, when I first walked out, the energy was like, we don't know what she's going to do. We have seen her do the Tom Brady roast. So in retrospect, I look back at how terrified they all are because they were like, she's going to be just as mean as she was to Tom Brady. I heard that from a lot of them afterward, that they were really scared. I wish I'd known that because I would have done something to defuse that. Next time's going to be a lot more fun because they know the tone I'm going to have. I am not going to embarrass you. And if you laugh, I'm only going to make you look good because you're going to look so relatable. Comment, like they know how to have fun? Answer, it is an opportunity for them. I did an interview before the Globes and they were like, who are you going to skewer? And I said, not really anyone. But in order to serve a compliment about a performance, I have to make a joke about it. So I wanted to say something to Timothée Chalamet because I loved him in A Complete Unknown. So I'll probably make a joke. And that got back to him. He was going to skip my monologue and get there late so he did not have to deal with it. I don't begrudge him doing that, but I left a message for his publicist being like, I'm not telling you the jokes, but I promise the jokes are only uplifting him. I would never do anything to ruin his night, and I'm glad they believed it. Question, I rewatched the Brady roast and noticed you say I'm sorry after a few of your jokes. I also rewatched your Golden Globes monologue. You don't say sorry once. What changed? Answer, I really wasn't sorry about anything I said at the Globes because I did not say anything that was calling anyone ugly or fat. At a roast, you say really cruel things. That's the job. And I did feel bad about it because some of them are my friends. I watched it back, which I never do, but I caught those sorries too. I'm like, where was that coming from? But it was just how I felt. Question, you make fun of your struggles to the point that your tour is called Alive and Unwell. But in a recent Instagram, you said you've never been busier or happier. How does that affect your comedy? Answer, I am happier than I've ever been, but I'm not happy by any means. I am happier than I've ever been, but I am not happy by any means. I am so grateful, but I still have a lot of self-loathing that's almost getting boring to talk about. It is two-pronged. I think I don't deserve it, and I have imposter syndrome. There's also the idea that my success is going to go away, and I don't want it to. Everyone's like, you never let your wins in. I'm like, I cannot let this in. I am never getting this again. You can't get hurt if you don't let things in. So I'm just staying hungry, just in case. And the last comment, you said recently you are afraid of getting death threats over political humor. And the answer, I have a fairly liberal fan base, but it is actually more mixed than I would have thought. No matter what your beliefs are, how much I disagree, you are paying to come see me. So I'm not going to be like, what you did was stupid, you're ruining our country. I slip it in here and there, but I don't really explore that on stage. I am not trying to be an alarmist, but I do not think I'm immune to having some kind of backlash. So I'm on a list at this point, but he's so hot that even though I may disagree with his policies, I'm so sexually attracted to him. I am 100% real about that, and I will always maintain that, and that will save me when I'm on the gallows. In this edition of Time, they include something called Time 100 Health. The most influential people in health in 2025, according to Time. In our last few minutes together, I'm going to read a few of them. Kristen Peck, Preventing Animal Disease, by Matt Fuchs. Animals can help humans live longer, says Kristen Peck, CEO of the global animal health company Zoetis, Zoetis, which distributes vaccines for 8 animal species in over 100 countries. Zoetis has developed a new vaccine to protect chickens from the currently circulating H5N1 bird flu virus that has infected 168 million birds in the U.S. since early 2022, ravaging the poultry industry. In February, the U.S. government issued a license for the vaccine, though it has yet to be distributed for use in poultry farms. David Ricks, R-I-C-K-S, Speeding Drug Development. Eli Lilly, CEO. David Ricks' push for speed and his bets on the next breakthroughs have paid off, both for the company's stockholders and for patients. Lilly's stock is valued at close to $900 billion, and its treatments often surpass those of its rivals. In July, the FDA approved its Alzheimer's treatment, which outperforms its competitor at reducing cognitive decline. Its diabetes and obesity treatments are also more effective than the competition. And in April, Lilly announced encouraging early data on its first oral formulation of the drugs. Sumbul Desai, D-E-S-A-I, Merging Tech and Health. As Vice President of Health at Apple, Sumbul Desai thinks creatively about how technology can improve wellness. In 2024, Apple received approval to turn the iPhone into a professional-grade hearing test, and AirPods Pro 2 got the go-ahead to function as hearing aids. The same year, the Apple Watch was cleared by the FDA to detect sleep apnea. We want to make health approachable, not scary, and empower you with health information so you can be more proactive, she says. Alice Walton, Enriching Medical Education. As the richest woman in the world, Alice Walton could turn her resources to any cause. She chose health. Doctors are not trained in nutrition and preventive care because they're not paid to do it, she says. Her solution was to create the Alice Walton School of Medicine in Bentonville, Arkansas, which will open in July 2025. And will train doctors with an innovative approach that addresses the whole patient, including behaviors and lifestyle, as well as physical symptoms. Those last three short articles were all written by Alice Park. Jonas R. Awadalla, Awadallah, A Heroic Vaccination Campaign by Orly Halpern. Once UNICEF's top public health specialist in Gaza, Dr. Yunus R. Awadalla came out of retirement to lead health operations after the October 7, 2023 Hamas attack and Israel's subsequent assault. Awadalla salvaged abandoned vaccine shipments, found a building with a meat freezer to safely store vaccines. And when a resurgence of polio was detected in Gaza in July, led a nearly impossible campaign, vaccinate nearly 600,000 children across Gaza, despite destroyed roads, drone attacks, and disrupted communications. Over 90% of children were reached, but he is still pushing to reach the rest. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.